beloved Poddies and Gladdies, Laura Tingle, and I couldn't bear to be parted just yet. So after saying fond farewells last week, we've reunited for this program, the penultimate live program for the year, and I shall be mingling with Tingle in just a moment. I'll then be talking to Anne Applebaum, who's a Pulitzer Prize winner, about the growing emergency in Europe and the way the perhaps the fumbling of the refugee issue is being such a great boost to the far right. And then Rob Mundell's going to join me, and he's going to talk about pre-Cook explorations of Australia. And I'm pretty sure he'll probably talk about the Portuguese and the Dutch. But even Rob, radical as he is, overlooks my bloody contribution on this issue, and I'm going to take him to task, because I was the one that pointed out that Australia's only pyramid, the Shrine of Remembrance overlooking the Yarra, was built by the ancient Egyptians when they, anticipating Tor Heyerdahl by 5,000 years, they were blown off course on their way to build pyramids in Central and South America, and they whacked up this pyramid, and then they stood on the banks of that little murky river and chanted Yay-Ra, from which, of course, the name Yarra comes. Anyway, and then, of course, there's my discovery that Easter Island was covered with Malcolm Fraser's. Where is the recognition? Where, I ask you. Laura, you understand how bitter I am about this, don't you?
I do, Philip, I do. And I also want to know what you think about the whole Nefertiti thing.
Hey, what?
That she's secretly hidden behind the wall in Tutankhamun's tomb.
Oh, well, I'll tell you off air because, I'm not sure. Look, I want to be religiously instructed by Tony Abbott. Could you organise that for me?
Well, you don't have to go far, do you, Philip? He's out there and about talking all about the problems in Islam and how it hasn't had its own version of the Reformation and the Enlightenment. This is just horrible stuff. I mean, I don't know what this man is thinking, seriously. Every so often you just have to sort of cut loose on these issues and just think, oh my God, what was the former Prime Minister doing? And even his colleagues are saying very similar things because he's basically being the Donald Trump of Australian politics. He's doing it again tonight,
Look, I'm willing to attack Donald Trump with the best of them, but that's taking it a bit far. I mean, even...
But why?
Well, that's a bit hurtful to Donald.
Oh. Okay. We've got the new Prime Minister out there today just pointedly pointing out that the more restrained tone of language that he has taken on all matters Islam since he took over is on the advice of the intelligence agencies and the police, apart from any cultural sensitivities. And this was something that we heard a lot about while Tony Abbott was still Prime Minister, that the intelligence agencies were saying sort of very politely, look, this isn't helpful. Creating this sort of dissent in the community, it doesn't help us, in an intelligence gathering sense, apart from any sort of, this is not the intelligence agencies, this is me editorialising, apart from any complete officiousness at a cultural level that might be involved here.
I think we need an unintelligence agency to handle Tony Abbott personally, but that's just me. Look, he's not going to go away. It's not in his nature, is it? He's always dug in.
Well, he has always dug in, and if you think that he's basically now following the Kevin Rudd model of counterinsurgency, he's clearly not going to go away. But I think, as we've discussed before, Philip, the community is overwhelmingly over Tony Abbott. And all he's looking like doing is being a sort of political terrorist, really, basically being determined to bring down the coalition and all those in it.
Well, I'm glad you've mentioned terrorism, because, of course, there is some good news today, and that is Bronwyn Bishop wants to stay on so she can fight it.
Well, and as somebody pointed out on Twitter earlier in the evening, that's good because the level of terrorism in her seat of Mackellar has been negligible while she's been there. So, yes, no, look, it's all just, the year is ending on this sort of vaguely sick but high fast note. As I mentioned before, Tony Abbott's in Singapore tonight, spruiking all of this stuff further, arguing that there should be a boots on the ground war in Syria and Iraq, and basically really setting himself up as the Winston Churchill in the wilderness of his day as a means of coming back. And it's all just vaguely appalling.
We mock at the idea of his return, but we should take a deep breath. Tom Switzer wrote quite a nice piece about this in The Oz, you might have noticed this week, when he talked about all the people that came back when everyone had counted them out. And, of course, one of them was the aforementioned Winston Churchill, John Winston Howard, Kevin Winston Rudd, all sorts of people called Winston.
Yes, well, I don't think Tony actually has that as his middle name, but, you know, maybe that's the secret.
He does still fantasise, doesn't he, that the nation will call him back?
Well, he does. And you have to say, a lot of his commentary about what brought him undone as Prime Minister is nothing short of delusional, Philip, which is, I think, the alarming part of all of this. OK, we can all think that we, you know, we've been robbed, or, you know, we should have a decent shot at the top job or whatever. But you do have to have a pragmatic sense, and all of those people who you've mentioned, including Winston Churchill and John Howard, ultimately were able to see where they went wrong. Malcolm Turnbull as well. You know, that they've all sort of looked frankly at what happened and said, well, I stuffed that up. I have to change the way I behave and what I do. And Tony Abbott is having none of that. He's basically saying that he was right, that the 2014 budget was really hunky-dory, that he was undone by a poisonous media environment, which, given the, you know, absolutely unrelenting faithful support of News Limited, is an astonishing comment. So, I mean, I just find the whole thing beyond bizarre. That you know, it's fine to have a long term position on terrorism and all those sorts of things, but this is a politician who has not actually accepted and understood why it was that he was drummed out of the job.
Sorry,
getting excited here.
Let me pan over to the right and look and focus on something else, and I want to raise that. COAG, which has to be the ugliest acronym in the world. It sounds like you're clearing your throat and about to cough something up, but the GST at COAG. This is interesting. Will Turnbull really contemplate upping it to 15?
It's all becoming quite complicated, Philip, because for a while there it looked like the federal government was careering off towards basically trying to isolate the states on the GST, that is saying to them, look, if you want to raise the GST, that's fine by us, but be it on your heads. Now, Scott Morrison is now coming back from that position and essentially saying today, look, we can't reach an agreement with the states about what we're trying to achieve here. They're looking to fund services, you know, a shocking thought, I know, whereas we're trying to reduce tax. So we're not going to be able to get agreement with them. So we're just going to do what we are going to do, and they can work out what they're going to do in the meantime. Now, I think part of the problem here is that the tax debate has become so multifaceted and so complicated that I think everybody's having trouble working out the best political way of approaching it. So Scott Morrison has left open the option of increasing the GST to fund some of these other tax cuts in an overall tax mix switch, as they say. But he's also said that they might do some of these tax cuts without raising the GST, and is trying to sort of basically just take control of the tax debate back from the states, because the states are saying, well, you've cut our funding by $80 billion and let's start by discussing how we're going to fund that, fill that hole.
Laura, just a couple of days ago we were agreeing there'd be absolutely nothing to discuss about politics for some considerable time, and since then we've had the Ian Macfarlane story. Mm. Are people trying to pull the rug from beneath that distinguished gentleman?
Well, they have been. You can confidently say the Prime Minister was quite cross about Ian McFarlane announcing that he was defecting to the Nationals. But I don't know how successful the attempts will now be to stop that happening. You've seen all those senior Liberals come out in the last few days and basically say all sorts of very rude things about Ian McFarlane and what a traitor he is to leave the Liberals for the Nationals. But I think they were sort of hoping or expecting that the Liberal National Party, as it is in Queensland, it's a merged party up there, would intervene to stop this along the way. But the signs are at this stage that that's not going to happen. I still don't know that it's an incredibly wise thing for Ian McFarlane to have done in his own right. I mean, he'll probably survive the process, but you know, if we're talking about the history of people who've come back or whatever, the history of people who defect from one party to another or from one house to another or one from state politics to federal politics is generally not a happy one. So he'd be really bucking the trend if he actually makes a success of this.
Now, one more issue I'll raise before letting you go. Malcolm the Magician can't make McFarlane disappear, but he did a pretty interesting conjuring trick with Innovation Nation. Has it been a successful manoeuvre for him?
Look, I think it has been, Philip. I mean, you know, the cynical take on it is essentially a lot of the things they've done are replacing a backflipping on things that they've done previously. You know, they cut funding to the CSIRO and now they're putting it back. But that's not a bad thing. I think there are two things that are really important here. One of them is that they've guaranteed or committed long-term 10-year funding to sort of some major scientific infrastructure. So I think that's really good. They have tweaked doesn't really cover it. They've substantially reworked the way research funding is done in universities to make it more commercially to increase the incentives to have commercially based research rather than just look for citations in academic journals. So a lot of those things I think are about setting up the signals for a better innovative culture. It's not about just about giving money out from government and hoping for the best. It's about changing the signals.
On our last appearance, I was terribly fulsome and affectionate about you, and I won't repeat it all because I know you find it embarrassing. But, Laura, thanks for the year, and I'll talk to you in, whatever the next year is. I never remember what year we're in, actually. Laura Tingle, political editor, Australian Financial Review, and if only Europe had listened to Tony Abbott, they wouldn't have all these problems with the refugees. Coming up, Anne Applebaum. As our regular guest, Ioannis Varoufakis, said on the program a few days ago, the European crisis has unleashed centrifugal forces tearing nations apart and leaving the EU incapable of a coordinated approach to the refugee crisis. But the other alarming and predictable consequence of the crisis is it's leaving the EU vulnerable to the forces of the far right. Now, the admirable stand taken by Angela Merkel in welcoming refos has increased the number of arrivals, creating that ugly backlash with all sorts of strange responses. Anne Applebaum, columnist with The Washington Post and Slate magazine, author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book Gulag, A History, and director of the Legatum Institute's Global Transitions Forum. She joins us from her office in London. And before we talk about the issue, please tell me about the Legatum, if I'm correctly pronouncing it, Institute.
The Legatum Institute is a international charity, and we fund all kinds of programs designed to examine what makes prosperous countries. And my little piece of it is looks at countries that are in the course of making radical political transitions. And that's what I work on and write about.
And was Europe's current crisis preventable had leaders acted sooner to help the citizens of Libya and Syria?
There's a longer backstory to that, which is, would it have been preventable, or would it have been, would things have looked different if Europe had a foreign policy, if it was capable of making decisions that reflected its status as, treated as one, the wealthiest conglomeration of countries in the world. The fact that Europe hasn't had a foreign policy, it was able to bomb Libya, but then not to help create something in the wake of the destruction of the Gaddafi government. The fact that it had really no policy on Syria. The fact that it's been unable to contribute in any meaningful way to creating new nations or to stabilizing the nations in its immediate region meant that the consequences have now arrived on Europe's shores, literally, with both economic and political consequences, as you've just described.
And Merkel might be playing a political price right now for her stand, but it's hard to see that she really had much choice at the time.
Merkel's mistake was in how she framed what she was doing and how she described it. I mean, in essence, what she was seen to do by other countries and even by some of her own countrymen was to unilaterally break the rules. In other words, the Dublin rules, the rules that govern how immigrants are accepted into Europe, aren't working. Therefore, in essence, what she implied was anybody who's from Syria who can get to Germany can stay here. And that meant that immediately Germany became a focal point for people wanting to leave Syria, understandably so. But it didn't. It meant that more people were crossing the Mediterranean, and more people were making dangerous trips through Serbia and up mountains, and more people were getting sick and dying on the way. So it had the perverse effect of worsening the problem rather than solving it.
And then, of course, along comes the Paris attacks, which intensifies emotion.
The Paris attacks were intensified emotion, as they were no doubt intended to do. That was why they happened. And of course, they've become the issue of refugees and what to do with them is a separate issue from ISIS and what to do with it, and a separate issue from the radical jihadis who live in France. But nevertheless, in the public's mind, they are all confused, and the impression is now Angela Merkel led in Islamic terrorists, which is of course not correct, but that's because of the way that events unraveled. That's how it's perceived by many people.
Now, given that there are no borders between EU member countries, the talk of the erection of walls, not simply the talk, the action, the attempts to erect walls, fences, border checks, will necessarily lead Europe towards further division, will it not?
Yes, people are saying it's temporary. And part of the problem is that because there's no way of checking people at the outer border, in other words, there's no way of, on the border of Hungary or on the border of Greece, because those countries are particularly weak and aren't able to process people who arrive at their borders. Countries further inside the Union now feel the need to check people on their own borders. In other words, the failure is the failure to treat Europe's border as a real border and for everyone to take an interest. I mean, it's actually in Britain's interest and Sweden's interest and Denmark's interest for the borders of Southern Europe and Eastern Europe to be something that can be monitored. But it's been because Europe doesn't think as a whole still, and because it doesn't have a coherent foreign policy or a security strategy, that was never done. I should say that for years I've been hearing people say, we should do this, we should do this, we should do this, and it was never done.
Talking about foreign policies or the lack thereof, Germany's changed its policy by supporting the authoritarian Turkish government in order to stop people from travelling. And European leaders agreed to throw more money at Turkey and Africa in exchange for help in controlling the flows. Surely too little and too late.
Well, it's just a not a very coherent way of going about it. I mean, of course, we have to work with Turkey because most of the refugees are in Turkey, and helping to construct and build the refugee camps, finding ways to integrate refugees into Turkey or into other societies, whether it's, you know, European societies or Middle Eastern ones, is something absolutely that we should do. But yes, you're right. I mean, throwing money at that problem now, in this kind of belated and disorganized way is a farce. I mean, it's absolutely not how, you know, if you have to plan these things. The refugee problem has been there for years, and we've been seeing it happen for years, and people have been talking about it, you know, for months and months, have been saying we must do something, and now suddenly it's an emergency, and so Turkey's our best friend. But that's a very silly way to go about making foreign policy.
I should remind the listener that your husband was the Polish foreign minister from 2007 to 2014. Poland has just elected the populist Law and Justice Party, and although there are very few refugees, it's a place where the far right is exploiting the situation very successfully.
Yes, very unfortunately, anti-immigrant and anti-Muslim rhetoric became part of the recent Polish election campaign, and that was a real departure for Poland, for post-1989 Poland. There had really been nothing like it before, and it was part of the opposition's, of now the ruling party's, campaign rhetoric, and it was used by the press that supports them and so on. And I didn't think that was the only reason why they won, but it certainly helped give the election an unusual and rather unpleasant overtone. It's a kind of election we haven't had in Poland since 1989.
Janusz Varoufakis was predicting the rise or the, you know, an increasing problem with Golden Dawn, and we now learn that Golden Dawn's been getting some money from the Russians, and I understand that Marine Le Pen has admitted that her National Front Party got 9 million euros from a Russian bank. What are the Russians up to?
Well, the Russians have been funding the far right all across Europe for many years, and in many, many small parties as well as larger ones. I mean, yes, it's true that Marine Le Pen is funded by them. Jobbik in Hungary is funded by them. Several right-wing parties are funded by them in Greece and elsewhere. It's also true they fund the far left, so you have to be careful about assuming that there's a clear ideology behind this. In essence, the Russians will now fund anybody who works against the EU or against NATO. You know, they don't necessarily invent these parties, and they don't invent these emotions. As we've just discussed, they're part of national politics now in many countries. But what they can do is help along, you know, help with, you know, internet disinformation, and small amounts of money to far right and far left parties that are disruptive. You know, their goal is to pick apart those two organizations, the EU and NATO, because acting as a whole, Europe is much bigger and stronger than Russia. Acting as individual countries, as Germany or as Poland or as Italy, they are weaker than Russia. So Russia would much prefer to have a bilateral relationship with Germany and not a relationship with the EU. It would like the EU to disappear. And so that's the point of funding these disruptive and anti-European parties.
It might be useful if we discovered the Russians were helping Donald Trump. You know, at least it would up the ante. But are you as shocked as I am by the stridency of the ultra-right in the U.S. on this issue?
This is also new. You know, it's, and there's some parallels to what's happening in Europe, actually. I mean, it's again the use of the internet and these, you know, the far right and these kind of anti-immigrant groups and organizations and people and individuals are able to create now virtual realities on the internet. You know, a world in which thousands of Muslims cheered when 9/11 happened, which is, of course, something that didn't happen. Trump said it happened, and you can now find websites on the internet that tell you, yes, of course, that's what happened, and you can find lots of people on Twitter who will confirm your views. In other words, you can now create these alternative centers of reality, and the far right in Europe and the far right in the United States, we don't call it that in the United States, but of course that's what it is, have now gotten very good at using this extremist rhetoric that's now very much part of online conversation. And of course, this is the first time it's really burst into the open and been used by a mainstream candidate in a mainstream election.
Characteristic words of wisdom from Anne Applebaum, award-winning author and columnist with the Washington Post and Slate magazine. and director of the Legatum Institute's Global Transitions Forum. Avast me hearties, all hands on deck for tales of the salty sea dogs of yesteryear when buckles were so energetically swashed. The history of the east coast of Australia and its famous charting by Cook dominates national legend, but it was almost two centuries before his historic voyage back in the 1600s that Europeans began their romance with the immensity of what would be later known as Australia. And it may be known that the Dutch and Portuguese landed on the western shores of modern Australia some time before Cook, but it's not a celebrated yarn in our maritime history. Perhaps, well, for one reason or another, they didn't stay or try to lay claim over the land beyond the coastline. The Egyptians did make, as I said earlier, a claim on Melbourne, but that's also, I think, scandalously overlooked. Anyway, we're going to take a voyage of discovery into the past and plummet depths with seafaring author and journalist Rob Mundell. Rob himself, seafarer, and he sailed up from Yamba today to his home on the Gold Coast, and with this book has set sail yet again. Great Southland, heavens above, it's his 13th, and in it he charts an absorbing century when European navigators sailed south and east into vast unknown oceans in search of spice. Rob, welcome.
Thank you, Philip.
What started this? What triggered these epic voyages southward from Western Europe?
It was essentially the spice trade, because spices had been discovered in the Indies, in the Java and those areas, the islands around there, and India for that matter. And they were originally transported to Europe by boat initially, but primarily over land by caravans, camels, into the Mediterranean region. But as we know, if we're across our history, Da Gama found his way around the bottom of South Africa, and eventually it became apparent that there was a trade route, a sea route, that could be achieved around the bottom from Europe, around the bottom of Africa, and up into the Java region, the Spice Islands region, and that was much quicker and easier to transport spices back to Europe that way.
Now, we're talking about these tiny little wooden vessels, and what they did when they launched themselves on these journeys was every bit as courageous as what NASA was doing with, you know, sending out frail little spacecraft. And back in the 14th century, you point out that the Portuguese thought that if you sailed south past Morocco, you could be sailing towards the edge of the world, a place where oceanic monsters lurked.
Yeah, absolutely. And that was a fear with so many of the seafarers. They just didn't want to go into that part of the world. But slowly but surely, the encouragement came to go and have a look and go beyond. And they did just that. And you're right. That's exactly how it all started, until they got down to, as I say, the bottom of south of Africa, and then got round that corner and said, my God, we can get into this other ocean. And where does this take us? And eventually they found that they could get all the way up to India.
We're going to talk about some of the successful voyages, but with these intrepid boat people, is there the possibility, the probability, that a great many of them perished in their attempts?
Oh, no doubt, no doubt. And so much of it from that era is not recorded. But there's the other interesting thing in creating this book was the history far earlier, that the speculation as to who might have been here, who may have come into this region. And you talk about Melbourne and your pyramid. Well, it's a very interesting situation where about 232 BC, there was a small flotilla, five ships that are supposed to have sailed out of the Red Sea, manned by Egyptians, and that there's evidence in West Irian that they were in that region, because they actually were getting some level of comprehension of how to work out, calculate latter longitude, and that was the big
vindicated at last. I'm glad you're on the program, Rob.
Well, actually, I've got to.
I thought I just made all that up, and no, it turns out it's true.
I'll give you another interesting line there, because at the University of New South Wales in Sydney, there's actually a mummified body that came from Darnley Island, which is up off the tip of Cape York, and it is speculated that it was because the Egyptians came into this region that's why the body was mummified, because as we know in Egypt, when they mummified so many of the dead, they took them down the Nile and they transported their bodies to the other side of the Nile. Well, it is said that the Darnley Islanders of around the same era mummified the bodies and took them off to a coral atoll and left them there, just another form of what the Egyptians achieved.
But mind you, Erik von Däniken would go further, and he would suggest that the early exploration were from intergalactic visitors, but we'll leave that to another program.
There might be another book. But look, the situation there is, when I started researching that, there's another island there not far from Darnley Island, which you can see, and it is called Mer, M-I-R or M-E-R, whichever way. But the word, as it sounds phonetically, in Egyptian translates to pyramid. And if you look at that island from Darnley Island, it's the shape of a pyramid. So it may well be that those Egyptians were actually on their way to Melbourne at the time.
They were. Yay, rah. And hoorah for you, Rob Mundell. Now, okay, these adventures that we know about, these Europeans, they navigate through blistering equatorial stillness and wild monsoonal tempests in the 15th and 16th century. Their courage is staggering. And they apparently were pretty good at the science. They used wind, stars, charts, and notes from their predecessors.
Absolutely incredible what they achieved with what little they had. And we pale into insignificance as seafarers and sailors today when you look back at what they did. But like Jan Zoon with Doifken, when he came into the Gulf of Carpentaria, as we know it, and became the first European to set foot there back in 1606. His vessel, Doifken, was only about 60 feet long, and yet it had done three voyages out as a cargo vessel out to the region, out to the Spice Islands. And that was it, only 20 men on board, until some of them were slaughtered by indigenous people on the coast of Gulf of Carpentaria. But like, you look at that boat and what was done and how they navigated and how they got there, and those who followed him into exploring that part of Australia. Absolutely amazing.
Now, one of the things about those wooden vessels is that they were quite capable of repairing them, weren't they? If things did go wrong and they ran aground or something, they were bloody good carpenters.
Well, they were great. You had to have carpenters on board. You had to have spar makers. You had to have sail makers. You had to have everyone. You were a mini city where you needed people capable of everything needed to keep those vessels afloat. But then again, so often back then, the vessels literally fell apart around them. And that leads to the most interesting character I find in this book, and a man we know so little about. And that was William Dampier, who was... Interesting enough, I ask most people and they say, William Dampier, he was Dutch. He wasn't. And yet I know guys who've come to me and said, but I was taught at school he was Dutch. He was an Englishman and he was a pirate. And he went on to become this incredible explorer who went within 800 miles of discovering the east coast of Australia, like 70 years before Captain Cook. And it was only because his vessel was falling apart underneath him, just the weather and the sea and the wear and a tear, that he had to turn back. And he was coming over the top of New Guinea, destined to find the east coast of Australia.
But you make the point that this bloke who sailed from New Mexico across the Pacific with 140 unruly seafarers aiming to pillage, that his work did influence Cook many decades later.
No doubt whatsoever about that. He went so close. He went back to England and just received the biggest level of respect for his achievement and everything else. And he came back with enough information. And he was absolutely confident that coast existed there, and he wanted to get there. Had it not been for the tardy workmanship of the English shipbuilders in Deptford on the Thames River, he would have left early enough and come into the Pacific before Cook. the way Cook came, which was around the bottom of the Cape of Good Hope, and then come across to where Tasman had discovered New Zealand, and then come across to the east coast from there. So it is distinctly possible that Dampier would have discovered the east coast of Australia one way or the other 70 years before Cook. And that man is, when you read about him and you recognise what he did as a naturalist, as a seafarer, as a navigator, as a great sailor, he was the man. He was just amazing.
We can't possibly talk about every early salty sea dog, but we should also pay homage to Dirk Hartog.
Absolutely.
And he was quite literally blown into Australian history.
Yeah, and Philip, how that came about was the Dutch originally came round the bottom of South Africa and went up towards Madagascar and that area through the equatorial regions where there was very little wind. And one particular time, and it was back in 1610, only 4 years after Jan Zoon discovered the coast of the Gulf of Carpentaria, was blown off course while he was sailing into the South Atlantic and went way south. And he hooked into this westerly wind system, and it just blew him across at great rate of knots for those ships, which was about 5 or 6 knots, and got him to Cape Town. And he got there and he thought, well, hang on, that might be like a Southern Ocean version of the trade wind. So when he left there to go round, which would normally be around and up towards Madagascar, he said, no, I'm going to go south from here and see if those winds still exist, and then go across the Southern Ocean and then turn left to port up towards the Spice Islands when I think it's right. And it's because he went there and discovered that those winds still existed and blew across there and then turned to the north, he halved the time for these ships on their return voyages from Europe to the Spice Islands and back. So after that, the VOC, the Dutch East Indies Company, told all their ships, all their captains, that they had to go to the Spice Islands via the Southern Ocean and turn left, turn to the north when they thought they were on the right longitude. And when he did that, all these ships started coming across, and suddenly they started sighting land. And that land was the west coast of Australia. And that's how it really was discovered, because of what became known as the Brow Route. And yeah, certainly Hartog was blown off course, sighted land, went there, and that was, well, essentially the most western part of Australia, Dirk Hartog Island and that region. And when he went and reported that, that brought about more interest in, well, what's really there? What have we found? And it built from there.
Tell us about his famous dinner plate.
Well, the famous pewter plate, yes, he put it on Dirk Hartog Island, on the northern part of that island. He put a plate there with his name, the name of his vessel, the name of the senior members of his crew, and that they had been there. And that was found some great number of years later, and it's now on display back in Holland.
It was found by a Dutch countryman, and I'll get this wrong, Willem de Vlaminck.
Absolutely. And Vlaminck came into the area, and he was the one who knew on the latitude and longitude, the chart plots that had come, that island was there and that region was there, and this is what Hartog had discovered.
And he named Rottnest Island.
He did. He was looking for the survivors of another shipwreck. And there were shipwrecks scattered all over that coast as a consequence of the ships coming through and getting the wrong calculations on longitude and turning north too late.
And most famously, of course, the Batavia.
Absolutely. I just say the Batavia is the most famous one of all. And that was because they were off course. And, that coast is just dotted with wrecks of primarily Spice Island ships going to the Spice Islands that got blown off course and really thought, well, they weren't where they thought they were.
So it's the Dutch who lead the voyages of discovery. Tasman, of course, made two epic journeys around the western coasts.
And could well have gone very close to discovering the east coast of Australia as well.
And yet, as you point out, the Dutch made no effort to lay claim to the land or establish any settlements.
Yeah, in essence, the Dutch opened the door, but the British walked in, or the English as they were back then. And the reason being that they were only interested in trade. They weren't interested in laying claim to any great land. And primarily, or initially, Jan Zoon was sent out to see what land was to the south. There was speculation right back to Marco Polo days, et cetera, that there was land down there. Let's go and see what was there. And can we find a route into the Pacific to the southeast, the south-southeast, which will maybe lead to us getting an even better course back to Europe. So that's what they were looking for. They were looking for unknown peoples and ports and opportunities to trade or opportunities to find more spices or more produce or whatever that they can take back to England. But when they did get down there, they discovered it was so dry and so barren and the people were most unwelcoming and there was nothing there really to be had. So they, over a period of time, they essentially lost interest in what was there and concentrated on what they knew.
I'm talking to Rob Mundell, who's an author, journalist, competitive sailor, written 13 books on maritime themes, including Fatal Storm, about the legendary and disastrous 54th Sydney Hobart yacht race, the First Fleet, Hell on the High Seas, etc. Let's go back to the myth of Terra Australis Incognita, because that also plays a role. That is also an influence. I know it wasn't the decisive factor, but it was influential in conceptualizing these voyages.
Yeah, there was so much intrigue as to what might have been here or what was here, and that goes right back to the cradle of civilization, you know, in the Roman and Greek and all those incredible people back in that era, as to where even when they thought the earth was flat, that there had to be something in this region that would balance the sphere or the plate, the disc or whatever it was. But there was also at the same time a great belief that humans could not exist in that region because it was so much closer to the sun and they would perish if they lived there. But that I've traced and touched on much of that right through the book as to where it all started and really how we came to be here but it was the spice trade, as I say, that really drove it in the end. There wasn't any great search for Terra Australis Incognita, except, well, we're down in this region, maybe there is something here, let's go and see what is there. And Tasman was the man, as I say, who really went so close on one particular occasion to discover what was here. Interestingly there, he was way south in the Southern Ocean. It was only because he hit such bad weather that he decided, no, we're going to get out of this. We're going to go to the north. And they went up to latitude 52 degrees, I think it was, to continue to the east. And there was a thought then that what was there might go all the way down to Antarctica, which was still undiscovered, obviously. But it was only because he went up to 52 degrees and sailed that latitude to the east that they ran into the west coast of Tasmania. Had they continued on the latitude they were on, they wouldn't have discovered it.
Rob, there's some highly contested theories, claims and counterclaims about the Chinese. Have you looked into that?
Not to any great degree. We knew they were here, but there was no activity on their part on the northern coast, northwestern coast of Australia to take up any sort of form of residency. They were only interested primarily in the beche de mer, the sea slug, which was a form of food and for them, or a food source for them. And they came down here for that region. But there's nothing of any huge significance, any great evidence of them spending any time here, which I again found interesting. But they just came down, found the source of food they wanted and returned.
I remember doing programs quite a long time ago about the interaction between the indigenous people in northern Australia and seafarers from Indonesia. You know, it's seen in cave art. It lingers on in language. Is that worth exploring, those sort of contacts?
Well, I found that very intriguing, but I really had to, pardon the line, but I had to keep the book on course. I could have gone off on so many of those tangents, which I found intriguing, interesting, et cetera, et cetera. And I could have followed that much further with this book, but I had to stay on course on this maritime search, this maritime activity that really led to the British finally coming here and settling on the east coast of Australia.
I'm not criticising, I'm just enjoying our chat. Now, none of this, of course, reduces the majesty and the immense achievement of Cook, does it?
No, it doesn't. But again, I have to be brutally honest. I didn't know a lot about William Dampier before I started writing this book. I knew he was there and I knew he was going to be one of the people I researched. But the more I got into Dampier, suddenly I discovered, and I say it without hesitation, that man can now essentially stand beside Cook's shoulder as far as one of the great seafarers. The first man ever to sail three times, circumnavigate the world three times. What he did on those voyages, the situations he had to survive, his writings, because he was really the first naturalist to write about Australia, and what he saw, his observations were unbelievable. His writings led to, it's claimed, and I believe it's right, that led to Defoe writing Robinson Crusoe. And actually, I've got here, I just noticed, I've got a lovely, I talk about the way he wrote about what his observations were of flora and fauna and et cetera. One of his more famous was when he described flamingos and how they nested and they were in mud ponds, etc., etc. But the end of this lovely, lovely piece about flamingos, he writes, "The flesh of both young and old is lean and black, yet very good meat, tasting neither fishy nor any way unsavory. Their tongues are large, having a large knob of fat at the root, which is an excellent bit. A dish of flamingos' tongues being fit for a prince's table."
Have you tried flamingo to confirm?
No. I was waiting for you to do it first, Philip.
The amount of flamingo at Woolies this week is just, it's been terrible. You know, weeks pass, you don't see it.
It's week special.
Not a feather to fly with.
But he was, and when. This man was absolutely amazing, to the point where I devoted three chapters to him just because of what he did and how close he went to discovering the east coast of Australia. He actually arrived the first on his first voyage in King Sound up in the Kimberley region, and he arrived almost 100 years to the day there before Arthur Phillip arrived in Botany Bay and subsequently Sydney Harbour, Port Jackson.
How did he happen? What were his origins?
Well, he was a seafarer. He was born close to the coast in southern England, and seafaring and the like was the lifestyle there. And while he was on the land, there was no great future there. And he, as a young lad, went down and was apprenticed, for the want of a better term, is to a young sailor, and went off and sailed across the English Channel and in that region. But he had a spirit of adventure, so went up to London and sailed off into the Caribbean and that region on some trading ships, and finished up joining a ship as a pirate, or a number of ships as a pirate, a buccaneer, as they were back then. And they... that's how they went on and made their money. They were supported, in fact, which was quite amazing, by their government. The pirates weren't all that bad, or buccaneers, as I say they were called. But then they went around, sailed all the way around to the Mexican coast on this ship, and he on the ship he was on at the time. Then he boarded another ship called Cygnet and sailed off into the Pacific and came across that way. And when they got over into the through Guam and then into the area of the Philippines as we know it now, he knew that that there was this coast down there and there was land down there. So as navigator, he eventually guided the ship down there, and they went into King Sound. And he was quite amazed with what he saw there, and consequently he came back again looking to discover more of it, as I say, 70 years before Captain Cook.
Was there any moment in his life when he was carried shoulder high through cheering crowds? Was he awarded and rewarded in
he was
in
rewarded
England?
In he was rewarded in being given the Roebuck to sail investigate, to explore the region, and that was in 1699, and that was supported by the British government and the Royal Society, etc., etc. And one of the interesting things there was the British hydrographer at the time, Dalrymple, had translated some Portuguese documents, and in doing that, he realised they had probably discovered what we now know as the Torres Strait, and so
it was the job for Dampier also to go and see what was there or see if he thought that existed or whatever. But he was unsuccessful, as I say, because the ship started falling apart and he was running out of water and other things. But it was interesting there that the Spanish kept the existence of Torres Strait a secret for 150 years. The Dutch did try to find it, but it was all so shallow and so dangerous they never got into that region. So it wasn't until Cook in 1770 where he was advised to go and to try to discover the east coast of Australia, but also confirm whether or not what Dalrymple had found from those 150-year-old documents from the Spanish that the Torres Strait did exist, and Cook proved that.
I can tell from your voice, asking the listeners, you're very excited about all this. You're having a lot of fun with this, Rob.
I'm loving what I'm doing. I'm absolutely loving it, and I'm just about to start another book. So, I'm
on what, might I ask?
If I tell you, I'll have to kill you. No, not really. Look, I think that for me, and it goes back to my heritage, my great-great-grandfather was the master of a square rigger back in the clipper ship era, and I see a fabulous story there in the clipper ship era, and I think that's where I'm going with the next book. I'm in the throes of researching it now, and I'm down the track, and I think that's where I'll go.
And of course, there's still a huge amount of marine archaeology to happen on our west coast, isn't there? Because
absolutely.
You talk
absolutely.
About it as a maritime graveyard.
Yeah, for sure. And we there are wrecks there that we just don't know are there. We don't know where they are. And all that sort of that's down the track for maybe I'll look at that further down the track. But there's some great stories there as well. But I think this clipper ship era, which was, for the want of a better term there, there was mass migration. It really built the foundation for Australia after the first fleet, the discovery of gold.
We'll talk about that later, mate. We're out of time now. But, Rob, thanks. The Great Southland, it's published by ABC Books. And let me remind you, beloved listeners, that tomorrow night is the last late night live for the year. And we're going out with a bang because we're going to be talking to another brave explorer, but an explorer of politics. Her name is Gloria Steinem. Gloria's now, heavens above, she's in her early 80s and is as influential in the history of feminism as our own Germaine Greer. And she'll be joining me for an entire hour to round off 2015. Thanks for listening. We'll be back with Gloria in 23 hours. Thank you.